Good day, and welcome to episode 4 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. This week, we're examining downtown Guelph economic recovery after the impact of the pandemic. Our guests on the July 2, 2020 Zoom breakfast meeting were Julia Grady, a member of the Mayor's Task Force on Economic Recovery, the Executive Director of the Shared Workspace 10C, and a prominent community collaborator on social innovation. She was joined by Marty Williams, the Executive Director of the Downtown Guelph Business Association, and also a task force member. You'll also hear comments and questions from Jennifer Hesch, the Vice President of the Upper Grand Elementary Teachers Federation, and Kevin Sutton from the Guelph Black Lives Matter chapter, asking about labor and BIPOC representation on that mayor's task force. Another participant, Ron East, was from the Council of Canadians. Our moderator was Dustin Brown. Here's Dustin.
Great. So I'm going to ask Marty if you want to kick us off with 5 or 10 minutes, kind of giving us a summary of what you've been up to during the pandemic and what the Downtown Guelph Business Association's prospectus is looking like. Then feel free to take us away. We're glad to listen to you.
Yeah, well, it won't take 10 minutes because I think it'd be more interesting to hear what people want to talk about. But it's been rough, 100 plus days of uncertainty, 100 plus days of people being worried about whether or not they're going to survive, their business is going to survive, and new government programs rolling out and how they're going to impact, how they're going to function, how they're going to not function. Working with the city and the, frankly, we've never had a better relationship. We've been working hard on making things better for folks. And quite frankly, my hat goes off to city staff and city councilors and the mayor for really pivoting away from the usual sort of bureaucratic mindset of like we have to make sure that everything is absolutely bolted down and perfect before we march it out the door. And they've been they've been instrumental in helping folks figure stuff out. It's probably not a surprise to most people that the hardest hit among the businesses in downtown have been the restaurant sector, the restaurant food sector, because they can't open as usual. And it's a huge important part of what makes downtown function. When nobody's going into their office, almost nobody, maybe 10% of office workers, and it's a huge part of what makes downtown Guelph tick. When the cooperators and Skyline and the city and the county, to name just a few of the big, all the banks, all the office workers who generally buy a coffee and go out for lunch and do all these other things aren't there anymore. There's a lot of money that's been taken out of the economy. So the good news is that, again, thanks to the city staff and for the unanimous support of city council to expand and extend patios, to do whatever we can to use public space in a different way, with lots of restaurant businesses asking their neighbors if they can extend patios in front of their businesses too, and using public space for that purpose. Downtown is, I was there yesterday and it actually feels good again, finally, because there's activity. So COVID-19 has to be the first health consideration in anything that we do downtown. And then general AOTA regulations, health and safety regulations, and we're being creative. We're figuring out ways to make that work. And you know, the restaurant and pubs and bars and fast food services downtown are ready to go with the dining district idea, and to close the roads off on what we call the safe semester district, which makes the most sense because there's so many businesses, so many bars and restaurants and pubs, and very little retail that depends on drive-up car traffic. So it's I hope we get a decision this morning from the executive team to go forward with that. And what we're working on currently is to have that starting this week for Saturday and Sunday closed off, but then going forward, perhaps as early as next Thursday, just to have it closed off for the season, for the duration of the summer. And I hope that becomes an attraction in the absolutely perfect possible way, that it just fills with the right number of people and not too many more, not people congregating, not people standing around in unsafe ways, but we will have all the capacity that we have on the inside, and the outside of licensed establishments will all be on the outside. And I hope that will help businesses survive. We currently don't know if inside dining is ever coming back before we have a vaccine for COVID-19. And if that's the case, when October comes, it's going to make March, April, May look like the good old days. Because if we're shut down from October to next spring, I don't know. I take no joy in saying this, and I'm not usually pessimistic. I can't be a pessimist in this job, or I wouldn't be able to survive. If there's no indoor dining because of COVID health concerns, I don't know how most of the restaurant businesses will survive in downtown or throughout the city, throughout the country. It will be a massively, massively bad thing. So we have 10 weeks left of summer. That's the harsh reality. And we need to make hay while the sun shines and do what we can for these businesses. And I could leave it at that. And I'd rather just take questions or let Julia give her perspective.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Marty. I think you touched on a lot of things that are going to come up in the questions, and you'll have opportunity to talk about them more in depth later for sure. We still have a little bit of time for you. So I wondered if I could get a little clarification, and what are what are the bureaucratic measures that have been reduced on the city's part so that you can have the discussions that you need to have?
Well, it starts with the AGCO, sorry. Usually have to, you know, measure everything and check everything to make having a patio outside, and they have lifted those regulations. Basically said, if the city's okay with it, we're okay with it. And the city has taken that advice from them and said, we have to figure out every single way we can to maximize capacity. A good example is Bon Gusto in St. George's Square, which has an existing patio, but they're surrounded by a sea of public space that's completely usable for a patio extension. So the city can just say, Bon Gusto, you want to use the rest of this place, recognizing that you have to have AOTA compliance to make sure that there's accessibility to the other businesses, but take this public space and use it. And they understand the situation in a way that perhaps perhaps we didn't have to have that kind of laser focus before.
Okay, Julia Grady, and now I'm inviting you in. Same thing, you can give us a 5 or 10 minute intro. Just tell us what you've been going through during the pandemic, what your life has looked like, and how it fits in with economic recovery and work downtown.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Dustin. So I think what life has been like during the pandemic has been kind of busier than ever. 10C has been closed, obviously. And for those of you who don't know, 10C is a big shared community hub downtown. We work on the premise that we need to be kind of strong and resilient. We need to share resources. So, densely using an existing facility is kind of part of our main premise. So in March 15th, obviously, we closed. We have existing staff. All of the navigation of all the government systems was what we were working on. And then looking at grant writing. So we're a not-for-profit. And really, if you work for a not-for-profit right now, you spent most of the time between now and then writing grants and looking at work that you can implement either remotely or in new and different ways. Locally, obviously, the United Way and Guelph Community Foundation came out with the COVID Relief Fund, and then that expanded with the Emergency Community Support Fund, which recently dumped $1 million plus, so probably like $1.5 to nearly $2 million into local organizations. Through those, they're, I think, at least half of their funds allocated were for food-related projects. So obviously the economic impacts to citizens are huge and growing. So there's a lot of food support and emergency food relief that's happening. Namely, a lot of Hope House is doing a lot, as is the Seed, which is part of the Guelph Community Health Center. So 10C have been working with the Seed to help them launch that the emergency distribution hub, which now then has a number of organizations able to use a facility, and I think they hit something like 12 or 14,000 weekly food baskets going out into the city. There's a goal there of over 100,000 baskets through the city, which represents about 10,000 people. So there's a lot of work related to that. Through the economic renewal piece, the committee, I'd echo Marty's thoughts that staff and the representatives there have been highly collaborative. So one thing that gave was kind of a forum to start to rapidly stitch together ideas. So some of the partners on that team were kind of instrumental in some of the not-for-profit work that we've been working on. And then the Kathy Downer announced, I guess it was at council last session, the $300K going to not-for-profits upcoming in July, and that would be through the community well-being program. So I think that will be critical. A lot of not-for-profits that don't, not-for-profits similar to the independent business that is really preeminent downtown, don't have a lot of long-term good cash flow and or other ways to stay around. So I'm an optimist as well, Marty. But I'm very concerned about, there's a couple of different paths I think things will take, but I'm hoping that the not-for-profit sector still is highly relevant. Obviously there's a number of things to solve for. And there's nothing like the voluntary and the not-for-profit sector that can help all of this. So other facets of things that we've been working on are any work with our Food Future, which is the Guelph's Circular Food Economy Program. And there's a grant program for $5,000 that was meant to support food-related changes. So not necessarily emergency relief work, but maybe helping restaurants pivot to like a micro grocery or helping reduce food waste or whatnot. So that just the call, first call for applications completed yesterday, and that's meant to be it's only $5,000, but it's still a drop in and might help a restaurant or hopefully some downtown businesses kind of pivot and develop new kind of diversified things. That relates to a 0% $10,000 community loan program that 10C will be managing as part of our work. So all of the applicants into that stream will be eligible for this. And then if there were not 30 plus applicants, then there will be a second call. So that is all happening. All of this rapid funding is like first come, first serve in a way. So it's the pace of things I'd say has been very challenging, and lots of organizations have been really flexible. At 10C, we have we've spent the last couple of years working on different, I'd say, diversified funding in terms of programs and grant-funded work. So if this had happened last year, it would have been fairly catastrophic. We're obviously we only moved into the building after the renovations in fully in by January of 2018. So we're still pretty much in our kind of this phase of infancy there. But we have some programs that are we're still able to move forward. And for us, a lot of that's going to start with the shared commercial kitchen. So we do have a program through the Canadian Women's Foundation that'll be a pilot for five women who are experiencing adversity to launch their own food enterprises. So that will give it'll be about a 6-month program that lets them use commercial facility and then work with a team of people to kind of support their projects in a very kind of peer-to-peer and coordinated way. So that will be moving forward. In our reopen process, it's really around, we're starting today, so I'm still at home, but after this I'm heading in, and we kind of see a very, very gradual reopen. Obviously, patios are a burst of light for us to know that it's starting, things are starting back, but I see us really getting to phase three when people start to feel very safe. And then obviously all the sanitation and PPE and all of it all has been a big part of everything that all of these small agencies have been working on, which is, I think, been made easier by things like the Chamber doing bulk purchasing. The DGBA for downtown businesses helped a lot with signage and distancing pieces, which was good, and microgrant kind of facets. So I'm hopeful. I'm really glad that we're in Guelph, and our numbers are staying low, and people have rapidly picked up mask wearing. So I see us mask wearing everywhere now, and that's just going to be how we live with COVID, and hopefully our economic recovery. I think a lot of people have, in living with COVID, there's a lot of people who are still not able to return to work, even if they want to, and namely people with children. So this is still very, very challenging, and also very unfair to lots of people for different reasons. So I am hopeful, but also slightly concerned for everything. Sorry.
Yeah, I think that's a common feeling that a lot of people are going through. We want to hope for the best, but we know we have to prepare for the worst. I'm glad you brought up childcare, because that's something that I'm going to ask a question about a little bit later. But first, I just want to make sure that the whole audience is on the same page. I mean, I did a little bit of research on what the Economic Recovery Task Force is, but I would like to hear it from both of your words. So we'll start with Julia and then go to Marty if you want to fill in any gaps.
Sure. So Economic Task Force, I think there's probably 20-ish participants. And it's it seems like every 2 to 3 weeks now there's a call for an hour and a half, and we kind of navigate various things right at the beginning. And it gives an excellent forum for all three levels of government to come together, as well as there's a mix of not-for-profit representation that's fairly high, I think. And I know Marie from Hillside's there, and obviously Hillside has a huge economic impact in the city as well as all the cultural. We, in the first couple of weeks, it was more brainstorming around what are all of the upcoming issues that we see, and then how can we somehow possibly get, I think it's too optimistic to say ahead of them, but how do, can we be aware of and responsive to them? And immediately, obviously, was when there is reentry, PPE was, there was no access. So freeing that up was key. Looking at financing and how we can advocate for changes to the often maligned and correctly maligned CECRA program, which is the rental rebate, which is effectively has not been helpful. And then the mental health crisis that I think is clear as part of this. So all of those like broader topics are on the agenda, but then there's a way to kind of volley small short-term things. Like, could we shift for not-for-profits? A couple of things we threw in as questions were, can we shift the taxation policy to benefit not-for-profits, as they're doing a lot of the work of related to social systems? And then is there any opportunity for shorter term implementation of any of the electric transit infrastructure, and could that be used in cycling? So there's, I think it does give a forum. A couple of the meetings had been less around brainstorming and more around listening to like experts. So there was obviously sessions by public health and CMHA. And I'd say that as best as possible, staff and the team are responding. It's not the type of committee where there's ongoing communication unless there's like an immediate need. So as part of 10C's role, we kind of put out to our members, what are your core challenges and how can we kind of bring them forward? And so we're also, as task members, in kind of a listening state, which is also a big reason for part of being on the call today too. And I think that's fair. Marty can tag in with his, because I know that with downtown there's been a lot more outward response that's been needed for all the businesses, which is largely under Marty's umbrella.
Yeah, and I think the part of the task force has just been across the community, across the city, and we really need to have all sectors, small business, medium-sized, large business, the industrial, the large industrial folks, the university, Stewart College, everybody involved in talking about what's going on, all the places that impact. But I think Julia pretty well captured what's going on, and I think it is, again, I know just because we have two city councilors on, I'm not trying to say this because I would be, of course, in my job, I would be critical if I needed to be, but there has been a real change, and people recognize the nature of the crisis that we're in. And the folks from the city on the call have been very responsive, and how can we help is the new mantra.
Yep.
So it's good.
Okay, thanks for that. I wanted to, like I said, Julie, I wanted to bring up the issue of childcare, because I saw there was a press release coming from the Economic Recovery Task Force about how childcare is critical aspect of recovering. And a lot of people often will forget that because they're paying attention to other things, other aspects of the economy, things that tend to be paid more than, you know, the unpaid childcare that goes on in people's homes. So if you could, or either of you, if you could speak on what have the discussions been like around childcare and what are some ways forward that you've identified?
Yeah, I'll jump into that. I don't know that there's a solution until centers start to reopen and there's alternates. Obviously, the city's not responsible for childcare, but it's all been around what is safe and when can, I'd say, humans start to reconvene. I think the why is looking at reopening, but there's obviously not a lot of summer camp options in Guelph. I think I know of maybe two. But my kids are a little bit out of that domain. So it's, people who are looking for childcare, I think is going back to more informal community relationships. And I think everyone has a lot of trepidation around September, what that means. And, obviously if it's not safe for people to, gather and or pod outside of groups of 10, a system that has, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 kids together is very challenging for any organization to structure. So I think there's just been a recognition of that. And then changes in workplaces that I know everyone I work with, we're all digital, but kids are in and out, and it's, I'd say for parents, it's a super challenging time. So there don't seem to be any immediate solutions, but I think it's a timing and a pacing. And as COVID's first wave kind of goes down, then with all hopes, childcare will kind of open back up. But if it doesn't, I think we then will also have bigger problems in the fall, which Marty alluded to, but with not to mention just restaurants. The other piece, there's another piece on that. So I guess what people are doing are they're juggling, and parents are working at night and on around their kids and instead of their kids sometimes. And I think that's unfortunate. And the last piece was the university. So at the task force last week or the week before, Daniel Atlin, who's the VP External, updated that university will not be coming back in the way that it will not be a normal fall. So the economic impacts of the university community, particularly on the downtown and in all kinds of spending, is going to be significant. I think there will be less than 10% use of residents, and those for only like as needed cases, and some international students. And by and large, it sounds like classes will be the hybrid form, where most of it will be offline. Is kind of the update I heard Daniel give. So they don't have an exact number yet of what that impact looks like, but I think for downtown we should be aware that student spending is a huge factor and will be a challenge.
And Dustin, if I can just jump on that, I mean it is kind of Julie is correct, there is spending from students in downtown Guelph, but the majority of the economic impact for the city of Guelph from having 20,000 students come to town is not, you know, late night bars, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It's them paying rent. It's paying off the mortgages of so many people in this town have rental properties. There's something like $100 million in discretionary spending, and most of that grocery stores, shoe stores, the malls, places that students go to shop. But think about all the jobs, the cafeteria workers, the groundskeepers, all the other folks, the folks that are more precarious than tenured professors and other staff at the university who maintain their positions. It's the impact is going to be significant. And, you know, It's one of these things like, does working from home make us more or less productive? The pandemic has given us this grand experiment. Well, for those of us on this call who might think that the university has isn't significant to the economy of the city of Guelph, and for those of us who think these darn students, they're always getting their, you know, they're partying too much, or they're doing this or that, we're going to have the grand experiment of not having that happen for a year, and we're not going to like it. But I think that if there's a positive outcome, the people who think that having a university in a city of 120,000 undergraduate students in a city of 130,000 people isn't a major contribution to the prosperity and wealth of us all, I think you'll be disabused of that notion. I want to jump on the childcare thing, you know, sort of the flip side of that, having office workers, and again, people may or may not know, but, you know, downtown Guelph is a major employment center in this city. Something like 8,000 full-time so-called white-collar workers used to come into downtown Guelph every day. And they're not there anymore, or if they're there, they're there in very small numbers. And the economic impact of having those people stay at home because there is no there's no other childcare, no other options for them except to stay home and look after their kids, completely understandable. But that particular issue has an impact on us in downtown, the economy of downtown Guelph, in ways perhaps more significant than others. So that is certainly something that we're waiting to see. So even when offices can reopen with social distancing and other COVID-19 requirements in place, for so many people that simply won't be an option to come into work. So it's something we're certainly monitoring. But we're, again, putting on my on the flip side, that all the people that leave town who are going to work in Toronto and Oakville and Kitchener, Waterloo, Hamilton, now they're staying at home, and now they've got 2 or 3 hours of their life every day back to them. They've got, you know, more psychic energy and more money in their pocket. My hope is that we can convince them to rediscover their own town and to, you know, go out and grab a coffee, take a midday break and go for lunch somewhere, and support the small businesses in their own town, because now they have the opportunity that they wouldn't have otherwise had. Speaking as a recovering commuter, I know what that feels like.
Yeah, absolutely. Even, you know, I'm a student, I live downtown, and even just that half hour of, you know, getting on the bus or taking my bike up to campus, I've appreciated having that back. So we'll see what ends up happening there. And you touched on something else that's really close to me as well as a renter. You know, we're going to see some, I think, macroeconomic impacts of that as well. You know, the real estate industry is 13% of the national GDP, and that's more than oil and gas. And if that starts to crumble, then that's one of the things that makes me start to think, you know, transition my thinking from major recession over to depression and start worrying about that. It's good to bring up. I think there are going to be a lot of, you know, micro impacts. I would expect rent to come down with less demand, perhaps. Depends on when leases are signed. I know people are rushing to get leases signed at current market rates, so that they can maximize their revenue and whatnot. But anyway, that's a bit of a sidetrack. And I want to move on to stay focused on the task force itself. So I see in the chat a lot of people have been asking about the makeup, the membership of the task force, and I provided a link that people can check it out at and go through the list. But I prepared in advance, and I saw that there was a press release saying the mayor said, you know, we need an all hands on deck approach. And looking through the membership, I saw that there are 28 members maybe 20 have regularly showed up, but there are 28 who are officially listed. And looking through, I saw that there are, you know, 18 people who are described as CEOs or presidents or executive directors or bosses or business people, whether that's for profit or not for profit. 18 of the 28 kind of fall into that category. There are 8 government representatives or staff, including the mayor, Councillor O'Rourke, Councillor Gibson, Lloyd Longfield, Mike Schreiner. There's 1 academic, Abby, who I'm familiar with, and I know does a lot of good work with mapping technologies. But I didn't see any workers or labor reps. And I know Jen Hesch was asking about that. Where's the labor representation on the task force? Also in the chat, Dana was asking about whether there are people from marginalized communities, whether that be economic or otherwise. And then I now see Kevin Sutton, who's asking, are there any BIPOC on the economic recovery task force? So if either of you could speak to any of those, you know, concerns about lack of representation and, you know, just tell people how we can be confident that the community is being represented.
I don't think it's up to Julia or I to. We got invited to the party. We didn't make up the guest list. So ask your city councilors on the call to ask the mayor to expand the representation. You know, we're all, frankly, you know, we're going full tilt. We're in survival mode. And so we get asked to come and sit at a table, and we of course go there and have our heads down and our nose in the books, as it were. So ask your city council reps on this call to mention or to ask the mayor to expand the focus and to broaden the. Broaden the list, but I don't think I'm not speaking for Julia, but I don't think it's up to us to.
Yeah, I think that makes complete sense. Didn't mean to grill you there. It was just something that people.
No, it's, I don't feel grilled. And by the way, I'm an executive director, and that and $1.50 will get you a cup of coffee. So
right.
It wouldn't be too concerns about titles like that. So
yeah.
I think they're just trying to get people that were in leadership positions in a broad range of places. But I totally take the point that there should be broader representation and more voices at that. But it's not the one and only place where these conversations are taking place. But point well taken, and I think you should ask James and Phil to. Raise that with the mayor.
Great. One thing that I think was asked that you two could answer was, are there any BIPOC on the task force, that being Black, Indigenous, or people of color?
Yeah, I'd say there are. I don't think it's definitely not a lot of people, but yes, you could look at that list and find people. I do think that obviously, Marty and I are not defining who's on the committee, but if there are people either on this call or from other organizations that want to be on the committee, then I think there's also a way that we could kind of put other names forward.
Yeah, and certainly please don't conflate this thing as being like a star chamber. It's just there is no sort of special powers or things. It's more conversational. It's more like who's doing what and where are we seeing gaps and where can we cooperate with each other and various organizations. And if there are voices that are missing and people that can contribute to the community's response to COVID-19, certainly let's get them in the conversation, but it's not trying to be exclusive. It's not trying to shut people out. It's trying to bring people in and just a platform to hear about what people are doing and how we can work together.
like I said, Jen Hirsch, I wanted you to pipe in if you're comfortable to talk about your experience trying to get labor representation on this task force.
Hi, thanks. It's Jen Hirsch. And sorry if you hear any weird noises. My dog is right beside me here. So so I have actually contacted Cam directly via private message and email to his personal email address. And I have contacted a couple of other, like Mike Schreiner and a few other people, just to find out who was on the task force. Because when I originally went to the city's website, the link wasn't there. I came up with an error message, and I just wanted to know, was labor represented? Did we have someone there to represent unionized and non-unionized workers? And it also said on the website that there's an education rep, and myself being vice president and chief negotiator for the Elementary Teachers Federation, I have a lot that I could contribute and put in terms of an education perspective. But basically, I was directly told by the mayor himself, oh, no, we're fine. We've already got union leadership on the task force, so we don't need you. And then I was also told by his assistant that they sometimes invite guest speakers and they would consider it. And I yet to receive an invitation. And I've also met separately with Mike Schreiner a couple of weeks ago. We sat down and had a meeting for about an hour. And they said that they would look into having me possibly invited as a guest, but I have heard nothing but crickets on that. So that's been my experience so far.
Thanks, Janet. Yeah, it brings up kind of a theme that we've been talking about in recent weeks. It's just the struggle to have democratic process and representation from all aspects of the community.
I had a question actually that I had typed in, but I don't know if she got it. Just about, I've been hearing from a few local business owners from downtown area that are non-restaurant owners that are concerned about the reduced parking and the reduced access to their businesses, that it could impact them negatively. And is anyone, I was asking, I guess, directing it to Marty, if he had heard any similar concerns from downtown business owners that...
Yeah. Absolutely. So it unfortunately was reported in the press that, you know, the mayor's idea that we're going to close off all the roads, and that's not what is that's not what's coming forward. The reason why we're choosing the zone that we're choosing is because it has mostly bars and restaurants. There's something like 17 patios that are there that can use the expanded roadway. And there's very little retail. So we're trying to maximize the positive impact and minimize any negative or perceived negative impact of closing off the roads. For instance, closing Quebec Street would be absolutely ludicrous. There's absolutely no reason to do that. It's mostly a retail strip. It has one restaurant, and they can make other arrangements. Majida, you know, on Quebec Street. But this zone that we're talking about, and just to be clear, it's Wyndham Street from Cork to Carden, leaving Cork and Carden open, and Macdonnell from the entrance to the Macdonnell Street parking lot to the West Parkade entrance. So in that zone, sometimes called the entertainment district, as I said, 17 establishments that have patios that can expand. The reason why we need to shut the road down is because we do not have the city does not have the authority under the Planning Act to do what they have done in some other cities that have gone through the process. The city's currently going through this process to simply take over some parking spots and leave the roadway open to traffic, which means you don't have to reroute transit or do anything else. We can't do it that way. The only way that we can take any of the roadway from cars and give it over to patios is to shut the road down. That's the only option we have. So we're trying to maximize the positive input, minimize any negative or perceived negative. So keeping parking options open and having people that are doing curbside or delivery services can get as close as possible, because that zone has four access points to it. So it you get relatively close, you know, half a block or so away for somebody who's doing a skip the dishes or something to go and pick those things up. So it is, we hope we'll have that. And like I said, we have 10 weeks. I know other people have said in the chat that they have, they've heard that stage three will allow limited restaurants opening. I'm reading a story from California which reopened and now is seeing a second wave and they reclosed everything again. So I don't think that anybody has a crystal ball or that we're going in a straight line trajectory on this pandemic. So we got to use the 10 weeks as best we can. And as I said, you know, there's 8,000 people that are not coming to work in downtown Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. The only time it was ever hard to find parking in downtown Guelph was Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. Those people aren't there. You'll hear me say this and I'll probably never get to say it again, but parking is not an issue in downtown Guelph, not during COVID.
Thank you.
I have a question. It's Ron East.
Go ahead, Ron.
Oh, thanks. I'm quite disturbed by the conversation this morning. Mr. Williams mentioned before that we are in a crisis and we're talking about survival. My concern is that survival is not recovery. Survival is treading water, and fatigue's gonna come, and unless we're rescued by somebody, really there's, you know, and I don't think rescue is in the cards. So where is the vision to try to start to look at how we can survive, not only survive, but actually start to recover in a pandemic? And is the mandate of the task force to provide a vision so that we can actually start the recovery process and not just keep surviving from one day to the next, because we can't keep doing that for too long.
Again, Ron, I think that, you know, this kind of idea that the mayor's task force is some kind of that is the final word on what the city is doing is not a good characterization. It's a platform for conversation by among lots of organizations, so that we can understand what other folks are doing. And with respect, when you've just been, you know, thrown into an ocean, you know, treading water is the first thing that you have to do before you can see where the shore is. And we don't know where the shore is. To use your metaphor, but I implore people on this call not to conflate a task force that is you know, a group of people having a conversation and informing others of what they're doing or what the situation is in their particular sector with the be all and end all, or the only place that is doing anything, and that everybody else is just on the sidelines. It's not. And Julia, I don't know if you want, if you could jump in on that, but I'm frankly kind of like, I don't think that the tone of this is ringing true to me. It's just, it's a platform for conversation. It's not, you're not allowed to do anything because we're having this conversation over here.
For sure. And I think at the beginning, it was a way for people to hear what the impacts were and to see through the smoke, like as if we're kind of equating this to a fire also. So I think that's pretty fair. I think it's more of a a listening versus a dictatorial committee of this is what should happen. It's a way to listen, make other things happen that might not have happened otherwise. And my experience with the seed was one of those. It was a way to kind of like start to like open some positive channels that could implement very rapid solutions. There was a question. I do have a question for Marty, and then Kevin Sutton had a question. But the welcoming, this tags off the conversation last week or the week before, Welcoming Streets Initiative. Marty, can you give us a quick update on that? Because I'm wondering if there's an opportunity to expand the scope of that later, and could that be something that we are all bringing forward to through the task force? And then Kevin should chime in.
Yeah, I mean, the Welcoming Streets has been operating through this COVID times and continues to be. If folks remember that Welcoming Streets is sponsored by the city, Guelph Police Service, United Way, the county, Downtown Guelph Business Association, and run out of the Community Health Center. Outreach workers that are connecting both with street, sometimes called street identified people, and the business community, largely the storefront retail, on issues of poverty, mental health, and addiction. So it has been it's been a very successful program, and it's especially to have more people that are working with our most marginalized communities. So yeah, they've been working and instrumental, and certainly anything that could expand both their reach and the number of people that we can afford to have out there on the street, a good idea.
Okay, Kevin Sutton, you've been explicitly invited to ask your question, so go for it.
Thank you very much, Dustin. Also, thank you, Julia, for pointing out my question there. When I asked the question before whether or not there were any Black or Indigenous people of color on the task force, it was just for information. It wasn't an accusation. Felt like it was received as such, and in the first responses that Marty gave, the question was not addressed at all. It seemed like it came across as an annoyance. Now, I just want to clarify where we are in history right now, okay? We're at a point where people are marching in the streets to end the oppression of Black and Indigenous people. 5,000 people marched in the streets of Guelph to that effect. I can understand that no change happens overnight. And I know that when this task force was struck, it was struck in the mindset that we have been living in of who are the important people, and this is what it looks like. So now that we've had the list, there are not one single Black or Indigenous person on the list. There are two people of color, but not one single Black or Indigenous person on the list. So my question is, how are we going to take steps to rectify that? And even in this kind of arbitrary, we're just getting together to talk, why are Black and Indigenous people still being left out of the conversation? It's not like there aren't Black and Indigenous business owners in downtown. There are. And if you need the list, I can share the list with you so you know who to invite as you rectify this issue. But I'm just looking at, and like, obviously you're going to have to just spitball this, right? Because you haven't actually discussed this or considered it. But how do you think you'd be able to rectify this going forward?
Apologies, Kevin, if I came across, I was not responding to your particular question, but I see it now in the chat. Again, Julie and I were simply invited to come to something. We're not on this call this morning representing the mayor's task force. You should get the mayor on this call and ask him, and
please just answer the question. What are you,
Kevin? I don't control the task force. I don't invite the people to the mayor's task force. It's called the mayor's task force. And you're representing.
The answer is nothing. You plan to do nothing.
Can I jump in on this,
Kevin? It's not my role. I take your point entirely, and I suggest that Phil and James press the mayor on your concern and say that we need more a more representative and more diverse. I totally take your point, but I'll promise you this. I will tell you that I've heard from folks on this call, and when I talk to the mayor, I will say to him, I think that we're missing some folks, some communities on this task force, and some voices that need to be heard. I will commit to doing that. And again, I think that the more effective route would be to ask your counselors on this call to press the mayor on the issue and to broaden the scope of the task force. But we don't, Julie and I don't want to speak for her, we do not, I'm not on this call representing the mayor's task force. I'm here as the Downtown Guelph Business Association executive director who happens to be sitting around the table. I'm happy to share what I hear at that table, what we see, but I'm not representing the mayor's task force. And if that's why I was invited, I'm sorry, I'm here on false pretenses.
Yeah, I think that's clear. I know Julia wanted to speak to the issue a little bit, and Phil wants to come in as well.
Yeah, and I guess I would just kind of say to Kevin that as a task force member, one of our roles could be to use our voice to reflect that there should be other representation there. And Kevin, if you have names of people who would be interested in being on the Economic Recovery Task Force, by all means, I'm sure both Marty and I are happy to kind of put that forward. And in this, obviously, the task force goes, I think it's meant to be an 18-month commitment, so this will go through waves, and by no means is creating any like definitive action across the entire like city of Guelph and how it operates. It's one piece of a voice into what the economic impacts are on citizens. And I noticed a question earlier around more positive recovery. I think that might be why there are there's a disproportionate, I can say honestly, representation from not-for-profits on this, which at the beginning surprised me. But I do think that the not-for-profit and kind of like sharing economy, pay it forward business models are a way that we're going to start to move forward. So if there are others who are interested in those kinds of ways of working as we start to get out of this treading water phase and realizing the epic level impacts of this, then I think there should be other voices.
Yeah, this is a great issue of our time, of all times in the past as well. And I think still an indication that, because this keeps coming up in our meetings, the lack of representation that the community has when the city is having discussions. It's a repeated issue. People are very concerned, and democratic process is not feeling like it's not feeling like democratic process is being upheld for a lot of our community members here.
That's all the time we have for this week. Special thanks to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Ault, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gavert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us or have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. Thanks, as always, for listening.